Conferences. Long agendas, big venues, always on your feet, barely getting to see the people that you want to see, and then, of course, the expense. Well, the three of us at Good Morning Hospitality are launching Good Morning Retreats. Our first retreat is this July 8th through the 10th at the Horst Hospitality Training School in Auburn, Alabama. If you go to goodmorningretreats.com, you'll find out more information about our first retreat that we're launching. We have already filled half the slots. We have 20 available and we have about 13 already filled. So make sure you go there, you apply, show your interest, and we'll get you all situated for our first ever Good Morning Retreat. Thanks so much for tuning into the podcast. And now back to the episode.
This episode is brought to you by Reese's Peanut Butter Cups. In breaking news, leading scientists worldwide are conducting experiments to determine if Reese's Peanut Butter Cups are the perfect combination of peanut butter and chocolate. However, it appears the study was inconclusive, as the scientists couldn't help but eat all the Reese's. Because when you want something sweet, you can't do better than Reese's. Find Reese's now at a store near you.
Welcome to Good Morning Hospitality, your one-stop shop for the latest news, noteworthy trends, and thought-provoking discussions across the industry. From hotels and short-term rentals to all things travel and hospitality, you'll find each episode equips you with the information that you need to start your week. Join us on Good Morning Hospitality every Monday, wherever you get your podcasts.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Morning.
How are we both? How are we doing?
Yeah, great. Really
fabulous.
Good.
Sun is shining. No complaints.
Yep.
Yeah, that's good, isn't it? I mean, I guess, but the sun always shines in Barcelona, doesn't it, Sarah?
Maybe like 30 days a year it doesn't, and then all hell breaks loose. So we'll take it.
Who's had their first coffee? Who's done morning yoga? Anybody? Anyone have active morning? Yes, Sarah. Well, love it.
Yeah.
I had two coffees and a walk through Mondrique, so I'm good to go.
And I like it. Rafi was like, no, none of that. Guys, how we been? Rafi, what you been up to?
Yeah, I've been good. So I recently got back from China. Got a little holiday there. Got invited to a wedding, and it was my first time in China, which was really great. It's not a country I would have chosen like that for a holiday, but I actually really, really enjoyed it, and I definitely recommend it. It's pretty crazy. You know, you kind of go there, you don't really know if you're going to still have access to your WhatsApp, your Gmail, quite the adventure, but it was a lot of fun and I would definitely go back.
Very cool. Very cool. How about you, Sarah? What's going on?
Not a whole lot. I've been away almost every weekend for a friend's wedding and all the events leading up to that. And so it was really great. We were up in the Costa Brava last weekend, with a big old crew of friends that I've had for 5+ years and just celebrating love. It was nice.
Well, you guys are doing definitely more sort of adventurous things than me at the moment. My partner is ready to give birth to our second child. So we're not much further than sort of the front room at the moment. But still, it's enjoyable. It's enjoyable.
Did you guys choose it?
Okay. So we're still... So Rafi's interested. For context here, Rafi knows that it's a boy and Raphael is one of the potential options. No, we're still on long list. We're still on long list, and I won't say any more than that. I think there's probably five contenders at the moment.
All right.
Which means they probably won't get a name for the first 3 weeks, right? While we're working it out.
You'll let us know.
Yeah. Look, we should explain why we're here. So we've been given the mic by Will. We're very grateful. This is the first time we're doing this. This is Good Morning Hospitality Europe. And just to introduce myself, in case anyone doesn't know who I am, my name's Leo Walton. I'm one of the co-founders of Superhog.
Awesome. I'm Sarah Dupree. I'm from AirDNA. Been with AirDNA for almost 8 years now. So really excited to be joining in with some data and mostly opinion.
I'm Raphael Klein. I've been in the short-term rental industry for 4 years now. I work for Over Network. We specialize in high-end chalets, and I come from a hospitality background, actually.
Nice. Before we get into these articles today, I think congratulations is in order to both of you guys. We've had good nominations for the shorties. Rafi, what categories are Over Network nominated in?
So Over Network is nominated as Best Leisure Property Management Company. And then we have a second nomination for Louis as, so Louis is our director, Louis Andrews, and he's nominated as Rising Star.
Very cool. Very cool. Sarah?
Yeah, same here. We have three nominations, actually. We're super fortunate this year. So Team of the Year for AirDNA as being a leading place to work in terms of culture, which I can attest to. That's a fun place. We work hard, but we also play hard. We also have the Pioneer Award nomination for our CEO, Demi Horvat, and the Rising Star Award for James Kindersley, who's been doing a lot of conference stuff in the industry lately. So I'm sure many of you have seen him around. So, yeah, excited.
I love it. We've got a turf war here. We've got Louis Andrews v. James Kindersley. This is exciting. It's exciting. Don't come to blows, guys. Where's your money? Where's your money?
I want to see a duel, to be fair. It might be fun.
All right, guys, let's get into it. So the first article today that we're going to focus on, TripAdvisor blocks a record 2 million fake reviews in 2023. Sounds like a lot. That's an article from FocusWire. Rafi, do you want to tell us a bit more about it?
Yeah, so TripAdvisor is blocking a lot of fake reviews. One thing to note is it's not necessarily negative reviews, it's also going to be positive reviews. The whole aim here for them is to maintain the credibility of their reviews. Obviously, I know that as an industry, we really rely on reviews. I think even more, I would argue, probably more than other industries, simply because we're dealing with a lot of individual hosts and there's a whole trust factor that's really important for us. So yeah, TripAdvisor is really trying to maintain that trust. And what they're seeing is in 2023, they had a huge increase, actually 50% increase compared to 2022 in fake reviews. So one of my questions was, how do they figure out if it's a fake review or not? Apparently they're using technology, which is the similar technology to what's employed by Ford departments at banks. So pretty interesting. But yeah, it's a pretty big issue. this topic really interested me because I think there's quite a lot to say in terms of reviews. So one thing to note is TripAdvisor, obviously their review system is quite, it's open to public. So anyone can leave a review on anything. They don't have to have used the product necessarily. Whereas, for example, Booking.com and Airbnb, I believe it's based on a stay. So if you stay in the property, then you get to leave a review. It's not open to public. But other platforms that, for example, Over Network we use is Facebook, Google. These are platforms that anyone can leave a review on as well. And we have come into situations where we've seen one or two fake reviews. Luckily, it doesn't happen too often for us, but it definitely is a problem. On a bit of a side note, so I wanted to talk about the fact that whilst reviews are really important, I think I also want to maybe say that it's interesting because there's a company called Plum Guide. I think it's quite a known company in the industry. They actually had a pretty big campaign happening, I think, last year about all around reviews and how reviews shouldn't be trusted as much as we're giving them credit. And they were actually sort of advocating for a no review policy. And what's interesting is Plum Guide doesn't actually post reviews on their website at all. So because they have this whole system where they only accept 3% of the properties that apply to go into Plum Guide. So they're actually selecting properties based on, you know, having seen the property, having met the owners and all of that. So they're basically trying to tell people, travelers, well, don't trust reviews, trust us, which I think is an interesting take. I would definitely say that reviews can be very subjective. I still think that they're really important. What we do at Over Network is we do a bit of all three. So we're actually posting reviews. We're also giving an Over Network point of view on the property, which is supposed to be unbiased. And then finally, we're also allowing the owner to provide their own sort of story about the property and why they're doing this. So it's like a balanced take, I would say. So my question for you guys is what's your opinion about this whole situation? What do you think about reviews? Do you think we should trust them? Should we not trust them as much? Are we giving them too much credit? What do you think?
I'll jump in. First of all, I think that the cat's out of the bag with reviews. People use the internet and check what other people have said about a product. I also always take it with a sort of bit of a healthy pinch of salt, right? And I think again, not saying that they shouldn't be trying to remove fake reviews, but I think often you know that people have been incentivized to leave a review. So I'm not sure. I'm not sure I agree with the article that I'm not sure I agree with the action from TripAdvisor to kind of dissuade or remove incentivized reviews, because I think it's part of just offering a good service to somebody that you're aware that you're trying to delight them. And then as part of that process, you ask them to leave a review. As an industry, I think it is really interesting because, as you said, Rafi, earlier, if you're on Airbnb, Booking.com, and you've actually stayed in a property, that's very different. You know, you've actually been there, you've slept in the bed, you've used the lounge, used the kitchen. It's more trusted than a TripAdvisor review, which could be open to someone just anything positive or negative, right? And so I think I can totally understand why STR operators, hosts, make such a big play of trying to get that review. And ultimately, I wouldn't go and stay somewhere that had bad reviews. So it's obvious why they do it. Where I think it's open to a slight manipulation is if you're offering people tickets, you know, to a prize draw or vouchers, and I don't know, that for me is where I think we need to be careful, because actually it makes it less authentic for the customer. I don't know what you think, Sarah.
Yeah, I mean, I think an interesting thing to point out as well is the inherent bias, I would say, in reviews. So in 2023, just shy of 29 million reviews were left on Airbnb for properties in Europe. Having said that, that's 61% of reservations that had a review. And so still the percentage, it's not everybody that stays somewhere leaves a review. And if I'm thinking about when I leave a review, I either leave a review if I am exceptionally happy or really pissed. And usually it's when I'm pissed. So I think that weighs more heavily towards somebody having a negative experience. That's when, you know, if things go really awry, you want to let somebody know. And I think that's kind of the beauty, but also the curse of the review system in general. So for me, that's another interesting point to think about, is that inherent bias in reviews, even if they are coming from a verified platform like Airbnb or Booking.com or Vrbo, where, you know, you actually had to pay and the reservation is tied to it and there is some kind of control, there's still that inherent bias there. So something else to food for thought.
And there's a silent, what we're saying here is there's a silent 40% who are reasonably happy with the service they've received. Or we can assume they might be very happy. They're just not the sort of person who can be bothered to do reviews. There's a real laziness aspect to this, right, as well. You know, you only, like to your point, Sarah, you only go and, I wouldn't review a restaurant on TripAdvisor unless I'd had, an outstanding experience that was unexpected or a terrible experience that was unexpected. Rafi, and you probably see more reviews than Sarah and I do. Would you agree that that's the pattern with how people leave reviews? Very happy or very upset?
Yeah, so we see that a lot on Facebook. Actually, we only see negative reviews on Facebook because if they're really upset, then they try to post it everywhere. So they're going to use, you know, our review system, but they're going to go on Facebook, they're going to go on Google, they're going to get their friends to leave a review, even if their friends weren't part of the stay. So we're seeing a lot of that. Luckily, on our website, so we have a system where we email the customer twice after their stay. And that really does sort of remind people, because we also say it's really important for us, it's important for other users, so they know what they're getting into when they're booking this property. Generally our customers are really happy, so they're actually quite happy to leave a review. So on the website, we're able to actually post a lot of reviews, but Facebook does get a little bit of a bad reputation for that.
Yeah, I'm also curious about the amount of people who maybe don't leave a review, but they have contacted the host. So I did this, we rented a villa, a group of us last weekend for the wedding. And like, honestly, the villa was beautiful, but we were clearly the first guests of the season. The towels didn't match. There was no hot water for the first 24 hours. I messaged the guy about the hot water. Nobody responded to us. We ended up calling Booking.com. We ended up calling the actual agency that was managing the property. They told us to call somebody else. It was just a runaround the whole time. And finally, the next day, the hot water was working, but nobody ever said anything, or it was just like they just ignored it. So I messaged him. I was like, look, I'm in the industry. I'm not going to publish a bad review for you, but like, you got to get your shit together. This was unacceptable. Like, you got to do better than this. So I wonder as well how many people just think, oh, I don't want to ruin these people's reputation because it wasn't that bad, but they do actually give that feedback. So I'm interested to see some don't have any data for it. I'd be interested to see kind of what happens there as well on the back end that we maybe don't see.
Yeah, I think that's right, isn't it? I think some people would still feel it's mean to say something nasty when someone's trying to deliver a good service. But then the counter to that, Sarah, is, you know, we do need people to be better. And we've always got to be aware that we're in competition with a hotel that can just deliver new towels, you know, by sending someone up to the room to do it. So standards have to be high just for the whole industry to succeed. Is there something in sort of how much you're encouraged to leave a review? Because again, I guess I don't agree with the Plum Guide point that we should all ignore them. I think actually we should embrace them. But really, it should be that it's almost compulsory that you have to leave a review on a booking platform, and therefore you will get 100% of people doing it. That way you get a more accurate spread. Because I imagine for you, Rafi, there is frustration. It's the ones who, especially the marketing person as you are, there's frustration in the people who do nothing, right? The choose to ignore crowd must be the most frustrating, to try and understand what they've enjoyed and not enjoyed about your experience.
Yeah, I've never thought about it that way. I think I don't know how well that would go down, to force people to leave a review. I mean, at the end of the day, we're just here to try to provide the best service we can, and we don't want to be forcing them to do something they don't want to do, especially after their holiday. I mean, I think they have other things to worry about in a lot of cases. But it would be an interesting test, see what comes out of it. But I definitely agree. Like, right now, we only have a small percentage of people who actually do leave a review. And since it's all bias, like, how reliant is it to see the average rating? Is it a little bit on the negative side, because that's when people are most motivated to leave a review? Or, you know, what does it really represent?
If you force people to leave a review, I think that would just cloud the system as well. Like, honestly, when I'm looking at reviews, I mostly go look at the bad reviews, and I want to know the worst possible scenario, and then I want to see the best possible. So if you have a bunch of people saying, I'm just doing this because I'm forced to, or I can't make another booking on this platform, then I think it just adds noise and maybe is less helpful.
Certainly would lead to an uptick in one-star reviews as well, wouldn't it? Hearing forced to do it. So yeah, no one's going to subscribe to that idea. All right, great. Well, I think we've done that one. Let's move on to our second article, which is from Skift, which is, can short-term rental companies avoid growing pains by staying local? Now, I think we all enjoyed reading this article. Sarah, do you want to give the overview?
Yeah, sure. So, I mean, kind of the summary of the article is Dustin Abney of Portoro is talking mostly about how they have been super successful, and that as they're scaling, their goal is, when they move outside of Charleston, South Carolina, and expand to new markets, to remain hyper-local. So have a super hyper-local team, not grow too quickly. And the hypothesis is that many of the larger property management companies that have 20,000, 30,000 properties under management, like a Vacasa or a Sonder, have seen massive growing pains when they've tried to scale too quickly without keeping those local teams in mind. And I have to say, I mean, just, I totally agree with Dustin. In fact, Jardine recently launched, we're doing a pilot of recommending the best performing property managers in markets. It's something that our end users of our product have been asking for a long time. Hey, connect me with somebody that's going to do a good job. Dustin and his team at Portoro were selected to participate in this pilot program exactly because they're doing a great job and their reviews speak for themselves. And so their approach definitely does work. I'll open up to you guys, because I'm curious what you think, and I'll share some data with you later.
Yeah, so I definitely think, from my experience, local is the way to go. We operate in a very specific market. So we're in the French Alps, meaning we're dealing with small ski resorts, which all are so different. And you have to really understand what's at play in each of these resorts. You need to be connected. You need to be participating in the community. You need to know the tourist offices. You need to, everything is really done in a local manner. So for us, scaling is a bit of a tricky question, because staying local is, I mean, it's non-negotiable, meaning how fast can we actually scale realistically? We're actually trying to expand into new destinations. We're mainly focused on one region of the Alps. Trying to expand into more of the French Alps. And actually, we've got two new properties in Switzerland, but I'm seeing a lot of issues with that. As in, if we're going to go into a new country, well, we've got to really decide to do it and we have to be really strategic about it, because if we only do it half-heartedly, we're not going to get anywhere. From a marketing perspective, it's frustrating because I can't actually do proper marketing if we're only going to be present halfway. And then if the sales team are just going to be, you know, kind of taking the properties as they come, as opposed to doing like a proper launch in Switzerland, like understanding the local authorities and getting to know the people and talking to people, like it's just not going to work. And we're starting to realize that. I think from an owner perspective, when we're talking about a small scale company, it's really important because we're able to actually offer a personalized service. We're able to be very present for owners. Our owners are able to call us up if they have any problems. We're able to provide proper support, which I think is a really big differentiator for us compared to a typical Airbnb or a booking.com. So yeah, I'm not sure if you guys have any take on that.
Yeah, so I agree with both of you. I have got a counter thought as well, which I'll throw in there, but just to agree with you, I think very hard to have a premium product that you're trying to do at scale like that, because you're always going to be competing with somebody who understands the local market better than you do, that has pre-existing relationships with tradespeople, knows the culture, knows the language, is able to get their first five properties just by networking locally. I had an example of a client like this in London who has about 150 properties in the West End, sort of Southwest London, very expensive part of town. And again, I think probably she got the first 50 from being out at the wine bars with all her friends. And very, very hard. I think people would be offering her a small fortune for her portfolio of properties, but she's never been interested in scaling it beyond that locality because she understands it, right? And people talk about it. Oh, if you're going to get anyone to look after your property, it should be this person. So there's something very premium about that. And what I've noticed, and we've seen this in Europe, I think Sarah, Rafi, I'm sure you've noticed it too. This journey we've been on, that people have taken VC funding and gone quickly into different European markets. And as a consequence of being unknown in those markets and maybe trying to disrupt a local business that's actually pretty impressive and well-respected locally, you just have to undercut on price. So, and generally speaking, then your operating margins are at risk, and are you able to make it work locally? And before you know it, you've had to pull back out of that market. Now, there are obviously good examples of it. I'm sure we could all name some, but that's sort of first thing to think about. Whereas if you're super focused on a local market and just growing slowly and carefully and methodically, it does feel more likely that you're going to succeed in those areas. The counterpoint is, and I said, you know, I'll say this to you, Rafi, as well. And I know it's not over. You know, you've got different types of chalets at different levels. But it's like, if you're just in one market, obviously the fear is that tourists stop coming to that market. Maybe that you get a bad patch of weather. I don't know, regulations change. It maybe puts you at risk. I don't know, Sarah, if you've got any thoughts on that.
Yeah, I think there's two interesting things at play here. The first is the size in terms of number of properties that are being managed, because what we do know is that the biggest gap between a single operator, someone with, say, fewer than 20 properties, and somebody that has over 100 units, the biggest gap in terms of review scores is always coming from communication. And so whether that is just being understaffed or having too many properties and not enough people manning that communication, that's always the biggest gap. What's interesting is that we're doing something right in the professionalization of the industry, because another perceived difference is in the review scores for value that they're getting, right? So that makes sense. If you have a professional operator, they're optimizing pricing. So that perceived value for what they're paying is going to be different. But the other interesting point here, which also Dustin brings up in the article, is the speed at which you're growing and that hyperlocal approach. And so there is basically a 0.1% 0.1 difference in the review scores of property managers that are in a single market versus in 7+ markets. And so we really see the regression. So when you go from one market and then two markets, and it slowly goes down by basically a tenth of a point every single time that you add a market. And so it's no wonder that, of course, you can't scale that quickly if you're doing the hyperlocal approach. And that is what works best, right? Whether that is communication, whether that's language, whether that's, as you mentioned earlier, having a local team on board, Leo, that knows the area, or, you know, hey, I brought fresh bread because I have an agreement with the guy who comes into the town and brings bread in a van because maybe there's no panaderia. I don't know. Right. These little touches and these little things are something you just don't get when you scale super quickly and go into 200 locations at once. And I think the other interesting component there is the quality of the properties that you take on. So when you know a market really well, or when you're being really cautious about the way that you're scaling and intentional about that, you don't just take on any property. Whereas the second you start accepting BC funding and you have somebody breathing down your neck about growth, that's when things can really get out of hand, because you're willing to take on any property in any condition. That's going to have a huge impact on your reviews and ratings as well. And so I think there's all kinds of factors here at play.
Sarah, you nailed it. Sarah, we can't argue with that. I actually agree. I think you're dead right. I think there must be a cautious way. There's definitely a cautious way to do it, isn't there? But again, I think that's right. And what I was struck by when you were saying that, Sarah, was it's the word hospitality again, right? It's service. We're in a hospitality business where we're trying to provide a high-end service that people, well, not always a high-end service, a service that people expect. It doesn't matter how much you paid. You want the towels to be there. You want the bathroom to be clean, everything, you know. And doing that remotely is really difficult. So being able to scale that whilst keeping that hands-on quality is the challenge, isn't it? Great. Okay. Really interesting. Let's go to our final article of today, which is from Rental Scale Up. This is an exciting one. Booking.com ditches travel sustainable program in favor of third-party certifications. Rafi, do you want to outline this one for us?
So yeah, Booking.com has dropped its travel sustainable program, which was actually initially launched to incentivize hosts to actually get more sustainable in their practices. And the data that they were showing was apparently properties that were part of this program were actually drawing more bookings and more attention. Now, they've had to drop it because of some concerns that were raised around just greenwashing and whether this program was really serving the goals that were outlined. One thing to note, which is a pretty big point, is that when they launched the program, actually 1/4 of their supply became part of this sustainable program. So apparently 1/4 of Booking.com's supply is sustainable in terms of their practices.
It's ridiculous, isn't it? Well, I mean, it makes sense. I like how it feels like the European Union has helped as well to try and, go for this independent certification, which clearly is to, as you say, to prevent greenwashing. And I think the article's saying it's now at 16,500 listings that qualify. I mean, really, really important. If we are seeing an uptick in consumer interest based on this badge, it needs to be accurate, right? And I think the European Union does a great job here of doing it. The interesting thing I read in the article as well was that this is going to be compulsory, I think, for any company that has revenue over 150 million euros a year or something in Europe. So there's other players in our space that might have to follow suit. Sarah?
Yeah, I think it makes sense. And also, I think we have to think about the fact that they're following the money, right? I mean, it's all nice to say, oh, yes, let's do this. They're doing it because the money's there. So for example, in Europe, I mean, average daily rates for a one bedroom property, sit at about 98 euros a night. Whereas when we take into account what we would consider sustainable properties, so tiny houses, yurts, dome house, tree house, that average nightly rate goes up to 132 euros per night. And for some of these that are, even more sustainable, so like a tree house or a dome house, that's as high as 163 euros a night. So we're talking about a massive increase in the nightly rate. And that's ultimately what people are after. They're following the money. It's all fine and good to be sustainable, but if the money wasn't in it and they were making lower ADRs, I guarantee you nobody would be even interested. And they're trying to capture on that demand. And so it's, you know, I think the estimate in the article was over 60% of respondents were saying that they were super interested in a sustainable accommodation. And when you go to millennials and Gen Z, that goes way higher. So the demand is for sure there, but the money's there as well.
Yeah, I think that's right, isn't it? They're completely, you've said it there, they're completely following the cash, which is good, which is really good. It's good that consumer habits are moving in that direction. That you know, doubles down on the argument that it needs to be accurate, right? So that consumer faith in what's going on. Rafi, do you think all operators have cottoned on to the fact that it's a bit of a cash cow if you go in this direction?
No, I think there's a lot of skepticism around that, like whether it's actually worth going for. Is the claims of 60% of users wanting to book a sustainable property, like, is that actually reality? Is that actually happening? Are people actually willing to pay more for these properties? I feel like there's definitely a lot of skepticism around that. But, you know, we're seeing the regulation come in across Europe for sure. And there are some certifications that are starting to come out as well, which is, all of this is definitely helping us become more sustainable as an industry. And I definitely think that we need to be taking more action. Actually, I was speaking to Stefan from Hostfully, and it was quite interesting because he was saying he's actually going for the B Corp certification at the moment. And he was saying that just going through that process teaches you so much and expands your understanding of sustainability, because I think that at face value, we just think about the environment. I mean, I know I think about the environment mainly, but it touches a lot of other points, especially when B Corp for them, it's about governance, it's about workers, it's about community. There are so many other factors that need to be taken into consideration around this. And there's actually so much to do and so much action that we can take. So I think it's really around just educating ourselves more, understanding the issue at hand, really trying to make an actual difference and not just taking tiny steps that aren't going to make a real difference.
Yeah, I think the challenge in our industry as well is it's not hotels, so it's not homogenous by nature. And so when you're looking at, even a third party certification, I mean, I was speaking with Vanessa D'Souza at a conference a couple of months ago, and it's the same thing. Right? She's launched a fabulous new initiative to try and streamline this process for vacation rentals. But it is a mission, because every property is different. You can't have the same sort of checklist. I mean, you can try, but it's going to be very difficult, I think, for us to have that kind of standardization in the short-term rental industry. And I think Rafi brings up an interesting point as well about sustainability going far beyond the environment. It goes beyond not using single-use plastic. It's about, is our industry sustainable? So are we in an area where we're contributing to, you know, massive concentration of short-term rental listings that is then creating tensions within the environment? And what can we do, as industry leaders to make that better? And so if we are in a high tension area, okay, how can we give back to the community? Or, I stayed in Airbnb one time in Berlin, which I know was like high tension for quite a while. And they had a notice in the Airbnb saying, hey, by the way, we love to try and make Airbnb guests feel welcome in our neighborhood. Here's a list of all the charities that would love for you to come and volunteer for a few hours if you get bored while you're in Berlin, which I thought was super cool. I'd never thought of that. I did not volunteer. Full disclosure, but it would have been an idea if I had like some kids and they were bored, like take them to a soup kitchen, be great. So I think there's other ways that we can be conscious of how we're kind of giving back to the overall community surrounding the properties as well.
That's a really good point. It's a really good point to finish with on that one. The thought of my daughter in a soup kitchen, I can't see anyone getting soup anywhere apart from all over them, all over everybody and every wall. But that's a thought, Sarah. That was really interesting. Gang, we've come to the end of this episode. Thanks so much. If you enjoyed it as an audience, please hit like, subscribe, find us on Facebook, all those social media platforms. Until you see us again next week. Thanks.